gentlemen, I had never heard of the Education Trust about 10 years ago until I happened to get a letter in the mail at my principal's office telling us that we had won an award. And I thought that's really nice, didn't pay much attention to it, but didn't know who the Education Trust in Washington, D.C. was. When I came to a school district, our test scores were what most people would consider very poor, considerably below the 50th percentile compared to the rest of the state, and had been that way for many years. What I also found as a new principal, that no one was upset about that. They said, well, that's about where we've always scored. We're doing all right because we're in a very high poverty area and we are scoring about the same as all of the other high poverty area schools around us. So there's no problem. Why are you worried about our test score? It's a long story, but some of you who have been my students, we took our percentiles in the reading scores from the 40th percentile to the 85th percentile in a high poverty school to improve urban school. Our award was for the most improved rural school. It can be done and hired us a step further, and she has gone into those high poverty diverse schools and studied them and interviewed and found out what is going on in those high poverty schools where they are getting unexpected results, and has written a book and has come to visit us today from Washington, D.C. to tell us about it. And it is definitely another major piece to the puzzle of blowing the lid off reading achievement in your school, whether it's a high poverty school district or not. Please welcome Karen Chenoweth from Washington.
Very close to your mouth.
Is that work better?
Yeah, a little bit.
Right.
Okay, if I trip, just kind of wave your arms around. So I want to give a little context for what I've done. You've heard a little bit, but one of the things that happened when No Child Left Behind was passed is it sparked this huge debate about whether it was unrealistic, and not just whether it was unrealistic to have as a goal 100% proficiency by 2014, but how unrealistic was it? Was it mildly unrealistic? Was it wildly unrealistic? Was it utopianly, punitively unrealistic? I think you know what I mean. And so what I tried to do in this book is I wanted to try and get at that question. The other thing that happened with No Child Left Behind is that for the first time ever, we had enormous quantities of data about student achievement. Always before, schools had given or reference tests, hadn't paid much attention to them usually. They usually weren't publicly posted. Under No Child Left Behind, every school must report publicly how the kids are performing on reading tests and math tests, and if your state has other tests, science and social studies or whatever. But every child is given the same test, no matter where in the state they live. So we have 50 systems of publicly reporting. But for the first time, we can go and look at the data for each individual school, not only by overall scores, but by what's called the disaggregated scores, meaning by subgroup. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. How many of you are teachers? How many of you are here as parents? Okay. And how many of you are administrators? Okay.
I'll follow you around.
So, I went looking for schools where most of the children are low-income children or children of color or both that were either high achieving or rapidly improving. And I'm going to show you the data on a few schools. I should say, I found them. And I started calling them It's Being Done schools. And that's the criteria. The criteria, high achievement or rapidly improving. And either high poverty or high minority or both. So you can't see my cute kids. I'm going to try some more. Oh, he's going to help me. Is this any better? No. How about this? Is this better?
A little bit.
This is so weird. So this is why singers are on. Okay. So I'm really gonna try and do this. So you can't really see my cue.
Yeah.
Not
better.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you can't really see my cute kids here much because it's not dark enough. But this is a school in Atlanta, Capitol View. 95% of the children are African American. 88% meet the requirements for free and reduced lunch. And the teachers there, and you would really appreciate all the stuff that's in this classroom. This is not a teach to the test classroom. There's huge amounts of craft stuff and reading and books and so forth, but you can't really see them. This is the data for that school. Capitol View is on the left, Atlanta is in the middle, and Georgia is on the right. Red is what you don't want to see. Red is what you do want to see. That's the exceeding standards. Gray is what you don't want to see. You'll see Capitol View has no gray. All its children meet state reading standards. Same thing in math, only more than almost half of the children exceed state math standards. And look at it in comparison to the city and state. All these charts, by the way, not to plug my book, but they are all in the book. Here's a school, M. Hall Stanton in Philadelphia. 99% of the students are African American, 99% low income. The teachers there say, we have a white kid, but we don't know where he is. I mean, this is an incredibly cute kid, you can't see it. Okay, this is tough. I know you don't like this, but can we reduce the lights at all? No. So Stanton in 2002 began with 12% of its fifth graders meeting state standards. 12%. And in 2006 it was 70%. In fact, it went up a little bit in 2007. I haven't updated the slides yet. But you can see that Philadelphia went from 21% to 32%. Pennsylvania stayed from 57 to 61, fairly flat. So that's reading. Math's even better. Stanton is at 83%. Let me tell you, Stanton is in North Philadelphia. I don't know if has anybody been to North Philadelphia? Okay, you know what I'm saying when I say it's like Katrina land. I mean, it is a land of devastation. This is a terrible But in math, they went from 17% to about the same proficiency levels or proficiency rate as the rest of Minnesota, which, as you know, has a very high proficiency rate for math. So now we'll see a middle school. I've looked very, very hard for middle schools. I haven't found two in the country that meet my criteria. And this is one of them, Portchester. It's in Portchester, New York, which is a little town within Westchester. Westchester County is very wealthy. Portchester is a traditional immigrant town. It was German and Irish, then it was Italian, now it's Latino. So the school is about 65% Latino, 65% free and reduced lunch. I wish you could see these. I have to describe each one of them. So, New York State, this is English Language Arts in grade 8. New York is about flat. It started at 45% proficient in 2000 and it went to 48% in 2005. At the same time, Portchester went from 33% of kids, that's a third of the kids, to two-thirds of the kids being proficient in the English Language Arts. And the story's a little better in math. Elmont Memorial Junior Senior High School, which I have called the Holy Grail. High schools are very hard to find that meet these kind of criteria that I've set out to meet. 75% of the students are African American, 12% Latino, the rest are Asian. There may be a white kid in there somewhere, I don't know where. About a quarter of the kids are low income. It's not a particularly high poverty school, but it is not a school where people often expect academic excellence because there are no white kids. Red is Elmont, gray is New York, and this is the disaggregated graduation rate, meeting graduation standards. So New York has the Regents exams, which are given as the graduation requirements. I don't want to repeat stuff you know, but they've had them for generations, Regents. And basically all of Elmont's students meet the state requirements in English, and you can see in New York, 85% of the students meet the graduation standard, but only 3/4 of the African American and Latino students do. At Elmont, they all do. In math, these are a little bit old. The Elmont data has actually improved a little bit, but I couldn't find the state disaggregated data from the past 2004, which is a little crazy, but I couldn't. Elmont has improved. I imagine the state is pretty flat, because states don't change that much in a couple of years. So, the big question then is, what makes these schools so successful? And it's helpful to put them in the context of how ordinary schools run. I don't want to insult people here, your teachers, but you're here. And so it means that you're not accepting the status quo. So, ordinarily speaking, schools expect some kids to get it and some kids not to get it. Whatever they did is open on fractions, decimals, comma, use of commas, research writing, science, you know. Some kids will get it, some kids won't. Teachers are usually very isolated in their classrooms. They often have very little guidance in the way of curriculum standards. Everybody has standards now. Some of the standards are good standards, some of the standards, state standards are, you know, bad standards. Some are totally inchoate, incomprehensible standards. And I don't know enough about Wisconsin to know about your standards, but teachers often are told, well, the books are, you know, go find a book and you can teach out of the book. That's changing a bit now, but that is the classic way schools have been run. I have a slide in all those ways. Number one, they have very high expectations for all students. And that sounds like a slogan until you understand what that means. If we say, well, I taught the fractions, Johnny didn't get it, but maybe he'll get it next time when they spiral through the curriculum next grade, or, you know, maybe he's just not very good at it. Then you give up on that particular lesson, that particular kid. If you say, no, it's really important for Johnny to get fractions, I've got to figure out another way to teach him. Let me go talk to, the teacher next door. She, all her kids got fractions last year. I don't know, but what is it she's doing? Let me go watch her. Maybe she can come to a lesson for me. Also, principals in these schools will facilitate that. So it changes everything when you say, no, every kid has to get this. Because then the teacher has to really think very deeply about, okay, well, I taught my heart out. It's not that the teacher didn't teach it. It's that the kid didn't learn it. Once you make that shift, it takes the onus off of the teacher. The teacher's no longer defensive. I was really trying, but didn't get it. He didn't get it. I'm going to have to change what I do. That changes everything. It's not just a slogan when you say all kids will learn. So this is a classroom. This is Capital U. And these are very cute kids. I have to describe the pictures. These are very cute kids all sprawling on the floor and working on sheets. They're actually in French class. All kids in Capital U take French. The French teacher teaches the curriculum in French. So he's actually teaching a math lesson, and they are measuring kids with their shoes, or they're measuring the shoes. I don't know what they're doing. They're doing some kind of measurement math lesson in French as part of French lesson. Now, any teacher will recognize that's an enormous amount of collaboration that has to happen. The French teacher has to talk to the classroom teachers and find out what it is they're doing, what they would like to work on, how he can work on those lessons with those kids. So that's an enormous amount of collaboration right there. I don't like reading slides. Well, I think, if you don't all know how to make your cards, maybe you are dyslexic. Maybe I should. But basically, the assistant principal of this school says, if before you don't have access to trips to Paris, but you can still learn. So they are constantly working with this. This is a classroom at Elmont. This is actually a classroom that produced the most African-American AP World History test passers in, I think, 2003 or 2004. And at Elmont, the slogan, the philosophy is, we push our kids to excel. In other words, we don't push our kids to meet standards. We push our kids to exceed standards. And when you believe they can do that, they will be challenged. Number two, teachers work collaboratively to study the standards that students are expected to meet and then work together to plan instruction. This is a picture of a Capital U fourth grade team meeting with the principal. They meet for 2 hours every week with the principal and assistant principal. And they do this, teachers will be, and administrators will be interested to know, by scheduling the specials back-to-back for us. So kids have specials every day, but on one day a week, kids have two specials back-to-back, which permits the teachers to meet with the principal. Special being art, music, French, PD, finding that time is very difficult. Finding the time to collaborate is very difficult. But as Tony Monkey, the principal of Portchester, says, it is integral to the whole process. He says it's integral to middle school. It's really integral to this whole process. He runs a middle school, so that's what he says. This is the 8th grade team meeting they meet every day. 3 days a week, they talk about curriculum and instruction. 2 days a week, they talk about individual kids, and the counselors are there at that immediately pick up on any problems. The kids help the social workers. They will plan interventions for individual kids. This is not a little middle school. It's not a huge middle school, but it's like 750 kids. It's a normal sized middle school. It's big enough that, you know, people would say, well, we can do that. We have more staff. They do it with the same staff that everybody else has. And by the way, they're paid probably $10,000 less than teachers just 3 miles away in very wealthy Bronzeville. Expensive in Westchester. They have a very locally based system. So number three, they make decisions based on what is best for students, not what is best for the adults. This is a really hard one. It's a really hard one. This is a picture of a Portchester classroom. What you can't see is there are two teachers, and they're co-teaching. One is a special educator, and one is a math teacher, I think, a content teacher. And anybody who's ever talked to the teachers who have co-taught, has anybody ever co-taught? It's tough. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's like getting married, you know, and a lot of teachers are already. They don't need it. But the teachers here did it, and I assume you did it, because they felt it was important for the kids. And they put aside their personal territoriality, their personal, they have to have control of their classrooms, you know, to another teacher. It's a very difficult process. I don't underestimate the difficulty of it. But they do it because it's important for the kids. So they made that decision. But there are a whole range of decisions that have to be made in the school. I would go back, but I don't know. The way high schools build schedules, for example, often department heads will go to the teachers and say, what do you want to teach this year? And when do you want the prep period? The prep period is being the time that, planning time that teachers get. And their friends or the most senior teachers will get the early prep time so they can slide in a little late sometimes, or the late prep time so they can slide out a little early sometimes. They'll say, well, I want to teach the high kids. You know, these schedules are often built not around the needs of the students, but around the needs of the adults. It's very difficult to change that. To say, well, you know what, if you were really successful teaching, you know, English, I want to give you our neediest kids. That's a really hard thing for a principal to tell a teacher. Even though it should be a place of honor. Our neediest kids deserve and need the best teachers. So you get a low class, so-called low class, that should be the most honored teacher in the school, but it often isn't. So I see some heads nodding. Okay. Oh, all right. Well, number four, but I hope you read it. Number four is they teach. That means they don't teach to the test. They teach to the standards. They teach the content. They teach what the kids need to know. As such, they do not ignore art, music, history, and science. This is an art project done at Portchester. The art teacher says, I am an English language arts teacher. And she worked with the English and history teachers on their hall costume. And I wish you could see this, but basically these are paintings done by the students in the style, in the art style of David Lawrence, to depict different aspects of the Holocaust. So you have, you know, an Elie Wiesel kind of character standing by bunk beds, and you have different, very attractive, beautifully done paintings by these students. I include this. This is a picture of diorama projects. I include this only to show my broad-mindedness. I hate diorama projects. It's post-traumatic stress syndrome. But you see a lot of diorama projects, you see a lot of art projects. This is a school in Atlanta, a different school from Capitol P. This is Centennial Place. Festival and the Orchestra. They have science projects. And number five, and in the book I have like 25 characteristics of these schools, and I tried to narrow it down to five for this presentation. But number five, they are stubborn. And this is a teacher at Capitol U, and she says the expectation that we will fail pushes us higher. And every year, the teachers in Atlanta, like the teachers elsewhere, it's not peculiar to Atlanta, they often, many of them, dismiss the results of Capitol U. Well, they're cheating, they have more resources, they're small, they're this, they're that. There are a lot of reasons why, you know, what they do doesn't affect me, or doesn't affect what we do. We have different kinds of kids. They have smart kids somehow. I mean, if you went to Southwest Atlanta, you would know these kids are kids from Atlanta. They're not premium. These are all neighborhood schools. None of them are magnet schools. None of them are charter schools. But she's reflecting the general attitude that teachers in these schools often face, which is the other teachers in the area do not really believe it. So she said the expectation that we will fail. She's talking about the expectations of other teachers in Atlanta. That pushes us higher. We're going to show them. And I started to think of these schools much like I think of the Wright brothers. You know, they were told again and again, man and flight was impossible. Drag and gravity were just too overwhelming. We could not overcome drag and gravity to permit man to fly. Well, they didn't listen. And they came up with a way to overcome drag and gravity using lift and thrust. And with sufficient lift and thrust, man flight is possible. None of these schools is perfect, any more than the Wright brothers' plane was a perfect plane. But once you've overcome the theoretical problems that face you, then it's a matter of an engineering challenge. Then you go from the Wright brothers' plane to a Boeing 737. That's an engineering problem, no longer a theoretical problem. And so I started to think of them much as I think of the Wright brothers. And it took me a long time to find this picture, so I have to. And, you know, I think that with thoughtful instruction, careful organization, and what can only be recognized as big-headed optimism, high achievement for all children, or just about all children, is not only possible, but it's being done. So that's my presentation, and I'm happy to take questions. I think just parenthetically, following the Shavinses, I think you saw a couple of times when English and reading was not as high as math, and I really think that's because they haven't quite gotten reading instruction right yet. Really, you know, but I have great confidence that with the right, with the same leadership, they're going to just gnaw away at that problem until they get the reading instruction. So, any questions?
Very good. Can you talk about the criteria that you use in school selection?
Yeah, she asked about the criteria I use to make the school selection. I lay it out all in the book. The schools had to have significant populations of children in poverty and children without color. And it varied state by state what significant means because the demographics of the state has changed so much. Rock bottom, 25%. But most of the schools are at sea by great amounts, the 25%. Of children of poverty or children of color. They could not select their students in any way, so no magnets, no charters, no day schools. They had to have either very high proficiency rates or rapid improvement so that you could see that they would get to, you know, up in the 90%. in narrowing that. So that you could imagine that the African American students and the white students would be achieving this. I would love to find one from Milwaukee School. I did not find one. I'm trying to remember if we looked really hard. Some of the difficulties in finding schools, I don't want to bore you with my endless data scholarly, but states will change their tasks, and I need at least 2 years worth of data. And, you know, so I think Wisconsin changed its test in 2005, I want to say. So when I was doing the research for this, I was like, okay, we write off Wisconsin. You know, sorry. But I think you've now kept it for a while, so I'll probably be looking at Wisconsin. Yeah.
Even though you were just looking at more overall school indicators, did you see any commonalities in reading instruction or reading curricula that you could assign to these high-achieving schools?
The very, very high-achieving in reading schools. She asked about reading curricula. Had solved the reading war problem. For example, here's Frankfort Elementary. It's a very integrated school, very low income. It's rural. It's in poultry country, Delaware. So most of the families either kill chickens or take care of chickens, or they work in beach. They're service workers in the beaches nearby. So. They've got 100% and more than 95% of them reading. What happened in Frankfurt was they were using one of the normal reading programs, Hoferland or one of them, and they noticed that they weren't getting all kids reading. So they researched it and bought Open Court and mapped Open Court's introduction of phonics to Hope Midland so that each phoneme was introduced at the right time. I mean, they had to really work at this. And so they provide about 20 minutes a day, which is what the National Reading Panel suggested, for kindergartners and first graders, systematic explicit phonics. And then they'll continue that with educated who needs it, but most of the kids don't need it. Usually the kids who need more intensive phonics than them are the kids who move in after first grade. So they solved the reading wars problem, essentially. And, in a very pragmatic way, they're not philosophers. They, they weren't setting out to solve the reading problem. What they were doing is watching their data and following the data very closely. So they could tell them, we're not getting to that last 20 or 30%. We're going to have to do something different. So they did something different, and it worked. Lo and behold. Yeah. Yeah.
I was just wondering, do they have like a special ed population? All these schools, like with CD kids as well as LD and all the array of kids, that would be amazing.
Yeah, the question was about special education. And did this school have special needs kids? This school has 20% of kids identified from disabilities. I should have pointed that out. This school, actually, what's interesting about this school, I talk about it in the book, they were under federal supervision long before you guys were, because they had been identified by the Office of Civil Rights as having done discriminatory identification of special needs kids. So their African-American boys were all special ed, and they were all kept segregated. As the historic black school in the area, this meant a lot of kids. And so the principal came in under the supervision of the federal government, not appointed by, but she had an answer to the federal government back in the 90s. And so that's when they started studying the data very carefully. And they stopped segregating the kids with special needs, and they started including them, and they do a lot of co-teaching. So they have the usual spectrum. They don't have blind kids, they don't have deaf kids, because they go to a special school in Delaware. But they have orthopedic impaired, they have a lot of learning disabilities. So yes, they have So all these kids, all the schools are named in schools, so they have the usual run of disabilities. Yeah, go ahead.
How did their state test compare to, like, the NAEP test?
Okay, so the question was, we know that states have varying state standards. Some are harder, some are more rigorous, some are easier and lower. And how did I account for that in the book? And I have said, I didn't. there's no way really of accounting for. You can, these schools are doing the best they can with what they can. So they're meeting the standards expected of them. And I would most of them say, look, we teach way above the standards. But I can't judge whether they really are way above the standards or are just meeting the standards. And we don't have NAEP results, National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is the national report card. We don't have the NAEP results by school. So I really can't. I had to ignore that issue. We know Georgia standards are pretty low. So that's why I like to see a lot of exceeding standards. That's why WVU has a lot of exceeding standards. We know that Delaware standards are higher, but they're still not where they should be. New York standards are pretty good. So these are schools across a wide variety of standards. California is known as having the most rigorous standards. So if you see a school, it's very rare to see a school in California with anything like 70% efficiency. Even very wealthy schools, are still at 78%. We're still not getting, because those are very tough standards. Missouri has very tough standards. South Carolina has tough standards. They don't have very many kids meeting them, but they have very nice standards. So,
how about Wisconsin?
I couldn't do much.
Yeah. Where does Wisconsin fit in?
I think they're pretty average, as I recall seeing the data. As I recall, and I really should have phoned up on this before I came in, I apologize, but as I recall, Wisconsin, the percent of students meeting standards in Wisconsin is about where the percent of students meeting basic in NAEP. Is that right? Does anybody know the data? No, is that wrong?
Yeah.
Okay, so Wisconsin doesn't have very good standards. Yeah,
did you notice anything about how the schools that were doing well were governed? Were there more charter schools, or were they standard public schools, independent? And also, could you talk a little bit about the relationship of teachers' unions to the functioning of these schools? I know teachers' unions are often demonized by those who are seeking reform in education. I'm wondering if any of these schools had unionized teachers, were they cooperating, were they at odds, how did that work?
Okay, so the question was, what was the governance structure of these schools and what role did the teachers unions play? So the governance, these are all regular public schools, there are no charters. I went to my first charter 2 days ago in New York. I've been avoiding charters not because they don't have anything to teach us, but because if you say, well, look, these kids, poor black kids from inner city Newark, which is where I went, the answer is, oh, yeah, but they're more motivated. They filled out the application, their parents are more involved. You can't compare them. So that's why I kept away from charters until 2 days ago. are there any unions? Well, let's see. Is New York a unionized place? Elmont, Massachusetts is unionized. These are all the schools from my book, not just the ones from the presentation.
Were they supportive of your investigation into this, or did you ever get any assistance?
You call a principal and you say, I noticed your data. It just pops out, and you're doing something other people aren't doing. Can you show me? Nobody's asked for them. It's remarkable that hardly anybody ever goes until now. And now, that's because under No Child Left Behind, everybody's feeling the pressure. Oh my gosh, how are we going to do this? We don't know how to do this. So now there's some movement, there's something we hope to come see. But the resistance to going to these schools is huge. So the answer is, the principals have always been very welcome, including a principal of a school I described in the book, who should not have
Goodies provided for you, Travis, and check out.